Good morning and welcome to this latest Oxford Energy podcast. My name is James Henderson. I'm Director of the Gas Programme at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. And with me this morning is Anu Palmer-Sen, who is our Senior Research Fellow at the Institute. This morning we're going to talk about the Indian oil and gas market. Anu Palmer has written for us recently on the Indian gas markets and developments there. And in the last month she has published a paper on policy considerations around Indian upstream reform. So we're going to discuss both those issues this morning. Anu Palmer, welcome.
Thank you.
Lovely to see you.
Thank you. Firstly,
I'd like to ask you a question about a bit of history, if I may. We've obviously seen oil and gas production in India declining quite sharply. So why is it now that the Indian government is attempting to kind of revive investment in its upstream sector? What's the motivation?
Well, I think the motivation is entirely to do with a policy goal that the Indian government has, which is to reduce oil and gas imports by 10% over current levels by the year 2022, and to reduce them by 50% over current levels by the year 2030. So this relates to energy security, I'd say. And not just the security of physical volumes, but also fiscal security. So if you look at physical volumes, India consumes around 4.5 million barrels per day of oil, and around 80% of this is imported. And in 2017, India consumed around just over 50 BCM of gas, of which around 45% came from LNG imports. So it's very much to do with increasing demand for both oil and gas and how to meet these in the future. And when it comes to fiscal security, obviously imports imply a very large oil and gas import bill for India. And in that sense, when the oil price decline happened in mid-2014, that literally halved the Indian government's bill for oil imports. And that then fed into the current account deficit and the fiscal deficit. And so there's a growing policy awareness, I'd say, that it's probably time to look at how that bill can be controlled in the future as oil prices begin to creep up. And so I'd say that these import reduction targets and the overall goal of energy security are the two kind of driving forces behind this recent spate of reforms that we've seen in the upstream sector over the last 2 years.
And just to be clear, I mean, in terms of reducing the import bill, presumably this is in the context of rising energy demand. So, you know, what we're talking about is that the import share potentially increasing over time. And so this is really a race against time, is it?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at Indian oil demand growth, for instance, over the last 2 years or so, the demand growth has been doubling from what it was in, say, the previous decade. And if you just take the import reduction target of 10% by the year 2022, and then you look at India's current oil production levels and you try to project forward, what would it take for India to meet that oil import reduction target? India would have to increase its domestic oil production by around 40% over current levels, which is a massive number. So, and that's taking into account the fact that oil demand growth is going to continue increasing up to 2030 or even 2040. So it's a very, very ambitious kind of target. But at the same time, I think it's correct to be thinking about it in terms of energy security.
I guess we can come back to how realistic the target is. But we've talked so far mainly about oil. And obviously, oil is the biggest component from a fiscal perspective and energy security of supply perspective. How significant is the role of gas, given the potential for gas demand to increase in India over the next decade or so?
Well, gas is a relatively smaller proportion of the energy mix compared with oil. It's about, say, 6-7%. So in terms of the urgency, the fiscal urgency and the physical volumes, it's not as urgent as compared with oil imports. But at the same time, India does have a policy aspiration to double the share of gas in its energy mix from about 6-7% right now to about 15% by 2030. And gas is looked at as a fuel with several opportunities. So, for instance, there are opportunities to use gas in the transport sector as potentially an environmentally cleaner fuel relative to petroleum products. But at the same time, we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years that India's options around gas supply are a bit more flexible in comparison with its options around oil supply. So it has access to the liquid spot market. So it's been importing a lot more spot volumes of gas. It's managed to renegotiate some of its, well, three of its long-term contracts for imported LNG. And so there are a lot of options around sourcing gas supplies in the future. And if we think about the volumes of LNG that might potentially come onto the international gas market from 2020 onwards, it may remain a buyer's market for some time to come, one could argue. And so in that sense, I think that the opportunities around gas are recognized by policymakers and by the industry. But the urgency in terms of the fiscal urgency is probably not as acute as it is for oil.
Okay, interesting. So we've talked about, you know, the kind of targets that particularly oil production would have to meet in order to meet the policy goals. You know, in terms of incentivizing upstream production, what are the key challenges that you see the Indian government having to face?
So India's upstream sector has been liberalized since the late 1990s. The Indian government at the time brought in a policy called the New Exploration Licensing Policy. And under that, private companies were allowed to come in and explore for oil and gas in the upstream sector. And there were 9 rounds of bidding that were held under this policy. And if one analyzes each of these bidding rounds in terms of the behavior of the bidders as well as what happened afterwards, there are 2 concerns that repeatedly arise. The first is basically the concern around policymakers setting entry qualification criteria to the bidding rounds, which encourages healthy competition and healthy participation in the bidding rounds, but which at the same time ensures that the companies that do go on to win contracts then have the means to fulfill their work programs and to fulfill their contractual obligations. And we've seen that there have been problems over this in the past and controversies over this in the past. And so this is definitely one of the areas of concern. And the second sort of problem that's risen or concern that's risen repeatedly is the actual bidding criteria. So the fiscal variables and the work program criteria upon which companies submit their bids. And the concern around this is how to make this straightforward to assess. So how to make this administratively easier to assess, given the capacity and the capabilities of the regulator and the policymakers. But yet to set bidding criteria which don't actually give firms or companies incentives to modify their investment behavior away from what's best in alignment with the government's wider goals on energy policy. So I'd say these are the 2 main concerns, and it's going to be difficult to resolve these concerns. And I suppose one could say it's been a trial and error process so far in trying to get this right. So we'll have to see going forward whether these new upstream reforms adequately address this.
I mean, as soon as you start talking about work programs and bidding rounds, the word corruption immediately springs to mind. I mean, is that a problem, or is that something that this is aiming to address?
It's a very difficult area, definitely. I think that there have been concerns over this, but I think their concerns in any sort of country with the vibrancy that India has,
yeah,
and the complexities of policy making that India has. So it's definitely a lot to do with institutions, the quality of institutions, and the ability of the regulators to enforce contracts and make sure they're carried out. So, but again, that's a difficult problem. Some would say an analytically intractable issue if you were doing research on it.
So. Yeah. Okay. So what have been the most kind of important changes in terms of the fiscal regime? What are the standout items?
As we know, there have been quite a lot of reforms in the past 2 years in the upstream sector. And I'd say the most relevant change has been to the mechanism, the fiscal mechanism in the upstream fiscal regime. So under the previous regime, prior to these reforms, the mechanism was based on a profit-sharing contract. So companies would recover their costs from production, and then they would share their profits with the government in a proportion which was bid in the bidding rounds by the companies themselves. And a lot of sort of controversy arose over this in relation to assessing the capital expenditure of companies and monitoring their costs. and the government appointed two independent committees to look into this issue. The two committees came up with two opposite recommendations, and the government chose to go with the committee that recommended switching from the profit-sharing regime to a revenue-sharing regime, which means that companies will share their revenues from production with the government and not their profits. So if you look at it from an administrative point of view, it's far easier, basically, to monitor such a contract ex post. But if you look at it from an investment point of view, I think the literature clearly says that a profit-sharing mechanism is more progressive than a revenue-sharing mechanism. So we have to see what sort of investors come in to invest in India, and we have to see how they treat the balance of trade-offs in relation to the prospectivity of the blocks that are being offered for auction.
So in terms of the contract models then, we're seeing a different shape of model after the reforms. You've mentioned obviously the shift in the fiscal, but I mean, are there other aspects of the model that have changed as well?
Yes. So one of the objectives, one of the changes in strategy in recent months is the government wants to try and boost domestic production in a very short period of time. And so it's not just looking at attracting new companies to explore in the upstream sector, but it's also looking at trying to optimize some of the assets that are already there and in which, you know, there are potential reserves, but those haven't been developed. So the marginal fields, so to speak. And a lot of these marginal fields have been held by national oil companies, which were allotted acreage when India first started exploring in its upstream sector in the 1970s and 80s. And so the government's looking at some way in which to revive activity in these marginal fields. And the strategy so far seems to be designing contracts to try and suit specific geologies. And so for the marginal fields, there are two options that are being discussed. One of them is to just use a straightforward technical services contract where a private company would come in, a tender would be floated firstly, a private company would bid on the amount of incremental production that it could bring over a certain baseline level, and it would be compensated on the basis of dollars per barrel, let's say. And so that's one option that's being considered. And the second option that's being considered is for the NOCs to farm out some of their acreage. So a private company would be, through an auction process, would be allotted a percentage of the equity in a particular block and then would come in and develop the reserves in that particular block. So obviously there are advantages and drawbacks to either of these models. But I think these are the sort of directions that the government is considering. So that's in addition to an open acreage licensing policy that's been announced, where instead of the government announcing bidding rounds, at frequent intervals, companies themselves might actually come in and indicate that they want to bid on a particular area or acreage, and then the government would set up a bidding round around that. So it's becoming more liberalized. But also, I think there's a strategy for trying to tailor contracts to particular geologies and so forth. But India is not a resource-rich country, so we'll see how effective this strategy is.
Well, I was going to say that was my next question. I mean, you mentioned the prospectivity, and these fiscal changes, which arguably are somewhat aggressive in terms of moving towards revenues. What's the response of the industry so far, both in terms of the state companies but also private companies, both domestic and international? Is there enough prospectivity to attract them, and are these terms being welcomed by the industry?
Well, I think if you look at the marginal fields, which they have certainly attracted quite a lot of interest because they're perceived as being more prospective because they were among the first acreages that were allotted to national oil companies in an era where the upstream sector was closed. It wasn't open to private companies. And so there's definitely been a lot of interest around that. In terms of the upstream exploration rounds, I think the interest has waned since the new exploration licensing policy. Part of this is certainly in relation to prospectivity. The policymakers are trying to address this by the creation of a national data repository and sort of sharing of data as a public good with bidders who are interested in bidding for acreage. But I think it's going to take more than that to kind of reverse the uncertainty around India's prospectivity. It's more to do with administrative factors, with general business environment, red tape, and also the certainty of policy making going forward, the sustainability of policies that are announced, whether there will be any rollbacks in the future, and so forth. In general, I think the international oil majors haven't shown much interest in the Indian bidding rounds as they have in other bidding rounds around the world. But there are lots of smaller companies that have shown interest in, for instance, India's bidding round for discovered fields, which were small fields which were put on auction last year. And so so you have larger companies which might be needed to come in and sort of explore for new discoveries, which are not as interested perhaps, but then you have smaller companies which are interested in trying to revitalize some of those smaller discoveries.
Are those smaller companies domestic Indian ones, or are they international ones?
I'd say they're mostly domestic Indian companies that have won acreages in the smaller bidding rounds. But the rounds are open to all private companies, obviously.
So given that, I mean, how realistic do you think it is that the oil production target is met in such a short period of time? I mean, it sounds unrealistic, but I guess any progress is better than none.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that it's quite ambitious, and there has been a penchant for setting very ambitious targets. But as you say, then the perception is that, you know, meeting some of that target is better than not meeting that target at all. So
if I was going to push you, would you say that they can reduce their import bill, or do you think that given the growing demand, the best they can hope for is just to kind of maintain the import percentage at the current level?
I would say the latter. I'd say it's going to be quite hard to reduce that import bill within a very short period of time.
Yeah, okay. And so let's get on to gas then. I mean, we've seen some... Well, do you see? I mean, I was going to say we've been waiting for significant gas pricing reforms. Do you see those helping upstream gas development and therefore the potential for the gas market to evolve in the country?
Well, the most significant reform to domestic gas prices was back in 2014, as we know, when the domestic pricing mechanism was changed from an oil-linked price to one that was based on a volume-weighted 12-month trailing average of international benchmarks, which included Henry Hub, the UK NBP, the Russian domestic gas price, and the Alberta reference price. Some would say that's a very arbitrary collection of benchmarks, but it was based on international benchmarks. But what happened soon after that was there was a global decline in gas prices, and as a result, the domestic gas price also declined. And what's more, this price is adjusted every 6 months. So it's not an elastic price, essentially. In the last price revision, which was done on the 1st of April, which is for the six-month period from April to September this year, the price was adjusted, and it's gone up to the highest level that it's been in 2 years, which is just over $3 per million British thermal units, which is a pretty low price. And the government also has a ceiling price for gas that's produced from difficult deep water fields. And I'd say that if you were going to reform domestic gas prices with a view to scaling up the use of gas in the economy, you would want to look at setting a price that in some way reflects the prices of the fuels that gas is meant to be replacing in the domestic economy. And so the ceiling price for difficult to produce deep water gas from high temperature, high pressure fields does simulate that kind of a price, because it's linked to the prices of imported coal, imported naphtha, imported fuel oil, and imported LNG. And that price at the moment stands at about $6.78 per million British thermal units, which I'd say is relatively high, because India's paying something close to that for its LNG imports. So I'd say that should in theory incentivize domestic production, but then it depends on a lot of other factors as well. So I think going forward, it'll really depend on the evolution or the direction that this price reform takes, whether the price adjustments are made more frequent, for instance, whether the benchmarks are changed to reflect the opportunity cost of using gas in India, so include a linkage to imports of some kind in that particular, in that formula, So I think that those two factors are probably going to shape the impact of domestic gas, the pricing mechanism on domestic gas production. But again, if you going forward, if you see a lot of LNG imports coming onto the market, and depressing gas prices, then gas prices in India are going to stay low because they are linked to the prices on international hubs.
But I mean, I guess from what you've been saying, it sounds like the price for kind of normal, for conventional gas production is still really too low to incentivize major investment. The price for the more difficult, high temperature, high pressure gas is higher and sets some kind of sensible benchmark, but is it high enough to incentivize that kind of investment? I mean, it looks like, the record levels of LNG imports we've been seeing in the last couple of years are set to continue if gas demand is actually going to grow in India. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a role of for imports going forward. The thing is, if you look at the last couple of years, so India's LNG imports, as I mentioned in the beginning of our discussion, India consumed about just over 50 BCM of LNG, and last year that was last year, and around 45% of that came from LNG imports. So definitely, I think it's going to play a role in meeting India's domestic gas demand. At the same time, I think it's becoming strategically important in policy. So, for instance, you've seen a kind of change in strategy in the way that India goes about procuring LNG imports. So, for instance, the most prominent example is the renegotiation of those three long-term contracts. The first one was with RasGas Qatar, where India renegotiated on not just the price and the quantity, but it managed to get a waiver for that very substantial penalty of over $1 billion. That was followed by a renegotiation with ExxonMobil on Gorgon Pass gas, and that again was on price and quantity. And very recently, we've had the renegotiation of the 20-year contract that it has with Gazprom, which again has been on price and quantity. So I think that, that India sort of has the residual bargaining power in these contracts. And that's one part of the strategy. The other part of the strategy is it's been importing quite a lot more from the spot LNG market. So if you look at the volumes of spot to long-term contracted LNG, they've changed considerably. A few years ago, it was about 20% spot to 80% long-term contracted LNG. But in the recent years, those proportions have sometimes almost equalized. This is because India is making use of its flexibility with the long-term contracts and sort of thinking about strategy going forward in terms of obtaining spot LNG to sort of meet demand. At the same time, it's also managed to enter into an agreement with Japan for swapping its volumes of contracted LNG with Japanese volumes from suppliers around the world, which again gives it some flexibility in the way it procures LNG. So I think LNG will be important not just in meeting the physical demand, but it's also strategically quite an important policy. And it gives Indian policymakers an option which they can exercise when they need to meet high demand, for instance.
Interesting that, you talk about using the spot market. I mean, in the short term, that looks like a sensible strategy. In the medium term, potentially quite a risky strategy because at some point the market's going to tighten. Obviously, India's got bargaining power. It looks like a strategy for, which is prefaced on exploiting short-term advantage, but not necessarily having a very long-term gas strategy. Is that fair, or is that not fair?
I think, yeah, I would say that there is this target to double the share of gas in the energy mix, but at the moment there is no long-term roadmap, I'd say, for attaining that. And sure, I think that the stars are sort of aligned in India's favor at the moment with regards to the international LNG market. But there is some indication that they're thinking about a longer-term option for gas. For instance, talk around a new gas trading hub is one of those things. The expansion of infrastructure is another of those things. So I'd say India is a wild card on the LNG market, and we have to really wait and see. And I know that that's not a very certain kind of outlook, but it's different from what it was a few years ago when India was being written off, I think, in terms of the share of demand that it would contribute in the future. So.
I mean, I think, yeah, there are some very optimistic forecasts out there, not least from the IEA, about the future of gas demand in India, which I guess are easy to question given the uncertainties that you've already outlined. I mean, the gas hub question is another one where there appears to be a huge amount of hope, but the practical realisation of that gas trading hub is, as our colleague Patrick Heather would say, you know, takes many steps. How many steps along the road to a gas trading hub are we in India? I mean, is it just a pipe dream, or are practical things being done to facilitate that development?
That's a good question, and I think Patrick is right, because in many, if you look at OECD countries like the UK, it took almost a decade for a fully liquid gas market to develop. And so certainly I think for India, it's the beginning, it's the starting point. It's a good first step to try and commercialize the use of gas in the economy. But there are obviously going to be hurdles, and it's unlikely that it's going to transform India's gas sector in the short term. It's useful to look at what's happened in the power sector and to try and draw some lessons from there. So the power sector has faced similar problems with the modernization of grid infrastructure, with the expansion of infrastructure, with electricity access and so forth. And there were two power exchanges or electricity exchanges that were set up in 2007 and 2008. And that was meant to facilitate sort of short-term trading and more bilateral trading and trade directly between large consumers and producers. And essentially, if you look at the proportion of power that's being traded on those electricity exchanges since then, it's never exceeded around more than 10 or 11%. So that tells you that there are other factors that are hurdles to the scaling up of electricity, and the same would go for gas. And I'd say there are two main hurdles. The first one is affordability. So if gas prices are not cost reflective to begin with, then there's very little that competition can do to bring prices down. And the second one is infrastructure. So if you don't have the infrastructure to facilitate healthy participation on these exchanges, that will limit the number of off-takers, and that will then have an impact on competition. And then again, that means that a fully liquid gas market will be constrained in its development. So,
okay, yeah. Interesting. I mean, I think a final question that I'd asked to start, and coming back to the upstream question we asked at the front. With gas, I mean, do you see there being a constraint in terms of the development of the gas market if upstream reforms are not reflected in increasing production, i.e., if India is relying on imports more and more for gas, is that going to, from a security of supply perspective, constrain government policy towards gas per se? In other words, does the outcome of the upstream production essentially then, is it then reflected, do you think, in what will happen to Indian gas demand?
It's certainly constrained it in the past. So, for instance, if you look at, let's say, around 2010, when we had that large upstream discovery in the Eastern Offshore Basin start production, you can see that Indian gas demand immediately went up because there was supply available and because there was a lot of stranded capacity, for instance, in the power sector. So you had domestic gas that was being supplied at a price which people were off-taking that gas. So I think, yes, what happens in the domestic upstream sector certainly impacts the speed at which gas is taken up in the domestic sector in various industries. I mean, the three main consumers of gas are fertilizers, and we know in the fertilizer sector, gas demand is relatively inelastic because the government controls the price of fertilizers. So if it can obtain gas at a price which helps it with that bill, then it will continue to consume gas and LNG imports in the fertilizer sector. The second is industry, which refers to petrochemicals, refineries, and LPG shrinkage, which are being driven by growth targets within industry. And so that, I would say, is a reliable demand base for LNG imports. And the third is city gas, where there's a lot of potential, but ultimately the speed at which city gas consumption increases will be completely qualified by the speed at which infrastructure is built out. But since city gas distribution entities are unregulated on price, there is potential for it to consume a lot more LNG as well. So I'd say these are the three sectors that will drive gas demand going forward. But whether it then gets scaled up to other sectors and the speed at which it's scaled up very much depends on the speed at which infrastructure is built out, and in particular pipeline infrastructure, which at the moment is very heavily skewed towards regions which already have large existing industrial consumers.
Okay, Anupama, thank you very much indeed. India remains fascinating as always, and the potential for growth is there. We'll see whether it is realised and whether the government can use policy and fiscal reform to catalyse upstream and therefore catalyse some demand. But in the meantime, thank you very much for your thoughts. If you would like to hear any other of our energy podcasts, they're available on the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies website at www.oxfordenergy.org. But until next time, thank you very much and goodbye.
Thank you.